From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, men vanishing from workplaces in America and certainly here in Michigan.
Even when there's a job that opens up where you could be saying, do you want fries with that? That is a real hit for the self-esteem.
What's driving the big jump in the number of women getting concealed pistol licenses in Michigan?
Now my classes are, if they're not at least half women, it's majority women.
A memoir from writer Bill Haney sheds new light on some famous Michiganders.
He was Ernie Harwell. There was no artifice there, no pretense, no social, but yet public Ernie. There was just one Ernie Harwell.
And we'll find out what Battle Creek's police chief thinks of the new TV police show, Battle Creek. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Michigan has a higher concentration of industrial designers than any other state. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, could Detroit become a design mecca? But first, as the debate over gun rights and regulation continues across the country, Michigan is seeing a surge in women with concealed pistol licenses. In 2010, some 10,000 women in Michigan had these CPLs. That number is now up over 130% in just 5 years. Gratiot and Muskegon counties saw increases of over 400%. Rick Ector owns Rick's Firearm Academy in Detroit. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate it.
Was this a slow trickle that began to speed up, or was this a collapsing dam scenario where one day you get to your business and suddenly there's a brand new clientele and their voices are higher?
Well, there's that whole concept of the tipping point. When I started becoming a firearms instructor and started providing the classes back in 2006, there were maybe one or two ladies in like a 20-person class. It was kind of odd, I should say, numerically, statistically, when you look at the proportion of ladies who were in the course. But they back then, I guess, saw something that their fellow women counterparts didn't see. And as the years have progressed till now, I noticed like maybe 4 years ago where now my classes are, if they're not at least half women, it's majority women. The class I taught just yesterday, 75% of the students who were there were women. And it's just fairly typical for it to be a woman-driven market right now.
And what's the something? You said the women that you were seeing back in the early days of when you were an instructor saw something that other women didn't. What is that something?
I don't think it's just one individual incident, you know, some watershed moment. I just think it's just been a culmination of a lot of things that we've been seeing in the media. Continual stories about the unprocessed rape kits. We see the nightly telecast. Here's another woman that was raped, abducted. You know, and you see all these stories in the media, and I think women, particularly women who are single parents or live alone, really cast a pall in terms of their environment and that they really need to take on a more active role in their personal protection. And it's a common theme I'm seeing. And sometimes it's not even so much that they're really enthusiastic about getting a gun. Some women actually feel like they've been pushed up against the wall in the corner and that they have no other alternatives. A lot of women have really come to the point where they acknowledge that specter of danger and that they are at least willing to do what's required to take on a more active role in their personal protection. And one of the really interesting things about it, though, when you take these women who come to the class who are not enthusiastic about owning a gun and learning how to use it, and they've heard so many negative things.
You can see it in their faces and the way they carry themselves about it.
Man, I'm going to tell you, a remarkable thing happens when they realize that it's just a thing. It's a tool. And yeah, it can be misused by criminals and bad guys, but once they realize that there's a science, a methodology in terms of how to handle it, and ironclad rules that are easy to understand, easy to remember, easy to apply, it's just another thing that they need to learn how to operate. And yeah, there's some rules and laws that they need to be cognizant of. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a tool of last resort. When you can see someone who was intrepid, who had a lot of fear, a lot of doubts, and then you can see them confidently operating, manipulating, loading, discharging and unloading a firearm and actually putting that bullet on the target exactly where they intended mm-hmm. to go is a very empowering feeling for a lot of women.
What kinds of stories are you hearing from women who have taken your course and then gone off into the world with their CPLs?
I actually have quite a few women that have actually have had to use their firearm. And, you know, it's not
in
something.
In what ways?
Well, in at least one way, I know one lady had to shoot a guy. And fortunately for her, she escaped injury. The guy that she shot was actually an ex-intimate, you know. Love went wrong for whatever reason. And one day he decided to kick in the door and come in and try to assault her, and she defended herself. And people will say, you know, especially the women I talk to, they say, hey, go get a personal protection order. Have a judge sign a piece of paper and tell this guy, you know what, leave me alone. But they really have come to the realization that if someone, for whatever reason, is intent upon hurting you or harming you, it's really just a sheet of paper. I've had situations in which a lot of women have had close calls. They were appreciative of the fact that they had an option. It's a tool of last resort, and you can only use it when you're facing great bodily harm, a sexual assault, or the specter of death.
I'm talking with Rick Ector, who owns Rick's Firearm Academy in Detroit, about the great increase in the number of women in Michigan getting concealed pistol licenses, up 134% in just 5 years. Do you see, when it comes to training, is there a difference between the men and the women in your classes?
You know, I've listened to a lot of different fellow trainers out there, and they have a lot of different ideas. I've always taken the viewpoint that a woman can do anything that a man can do. All she needs is proper training and instruction. Some instructors will say, hey, she's a woman, you know, let's get her a revolver. You know, revolvers are less complicated to operate. They have less parts.
So dumb it down?
Dumb it down. She's just a girl, and, you know, she shouldn't need more than 5 or 6 rounds anyway. Me, I've always adopted the mindset, give them everything that you have and see how they respond. And I've always been supportive. I set the bar high. I say, hey, I expect you to do well. I expect you to be confident. I expect you to be able to manipulate this firearm. And you know what? To a woman, they respond. I've actually had women who actually had like a watershed moment while they're actually in the booth. And to see tears coming down, you know, it, for some of them, it's being overcome with empowerment. Some of them, it's like, okay, I'm finally facing this fear. But in those moments where you actually see this raw emotion from some of these ladies, their bullets are hitting the target right on the bullseye. And it's the darnest thing. You look at it and it's like, wow, I wish I had this on video. This was just incredible.
At the same time, you say you see this look of empowerment in them getting a sense of what they can do. You know there are many people who devoutly feel that there are way too many guns in this country and that people shouldn't be having guns in their purses. We had this terrible story out west where the little one took the gun out of Monsters.
I'm very familiar with that story.
How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think that there are too many guns per se in our society. There are way too many criminals who have access to firearms and are all too willing to use these firearms criminally. A person who lawfully owns a firearm is statutorily eligible to do so. Someone who is trained, someone who is responsible and otherwise law-abiding. You have nothing to fear from a man or a woman lawfully armed with a firearm who are carrying it for personal protection and self-defense. You know, it's really easy to take the actions of people who do bad things. And in a way, you're absolving the bad guy of their action. If he didn't have that gun, he wouldn't rape, he wouldn't rob, he wouldn't kill, he wouldn't do all of these sorts of things. And we just know from our history before firearms were even invented, we had death, we had great bodily harm, and we had rape. There's nothing to fear from a law-abiding person at all who's armed with a firearm.
Over the past few months, Rick, there has been debate brewing about arming female students on campus as a safety measure. Would you like to throw your 2 cents into that debate?
Oh, sure. There's no reason why a person should be barred from having a firearm just because they cross some statutorily defined boundary. You know, whether it's a college campus or whether it's a school, there's quite a few gun-free zones that we have. And what you find is that these gun-free zones or pistol-free zones, we look at them, and I say we in the pro-gun community look at them more like what we call CEZs, criminal empowerment zones. If we really feel that our children are, you know, amongst our most cherished resources, I really think that we need to do more than just pay lip service to these kids on college campuses and give them a means of protecting themselves. A variety of crimes happen on college campuses. You know, you might have the blue light campus phones, but, you know, violent crimes are happening on our college campuses, and they're rapes and there are assaults and there's robberies. These are very serious Part One crimes, and anything that we can do to help protect people, you know, I'm in favor of it.
And final minute, do you have any sense that there will ever be an end to this rise in female gun ownership in Michigan?
There'll be an end? No, I don't think that there will be an end. I think that there's just a fundamental shift in attitudes and mindsets among women. And you're seeing even some women celebrities who are coming out and voicing their support for guns. For whatever reason, it's been traditionally viewed, gun ownership has been viewed as a male macho kind of thing. But women are discovering that they can be feminine and own a gun and be protectors of the household, you know, just like a man can and still be a woman. And the market's responding because one of the issues women have is, how can I be feminine and still carry a gun? Well, the day is coming, and it's coming rapidly, where we're addressing that. And it's a great trend to see, and it will continue.
Rick Ector, owner of Rick's Firearm Academy in Detroit. Thanks for speaking with us,
hey,
Rick.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time.
Writer and publisher Bill Haney has crossed paths with some fascinating Michiganders, people like Dr. Jack Kevorkian.
I had some fine chats with him at some very posh parties. We'd go off and sit in the corner and just people watch and talk about books. And Jack Kevorkian was a brilliant and fascinating guy.
Coming up in 10 minutes, Bill Haney's new memoir, What They Were Thinking, Reflections of Michigan Difference Makers. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The city of Battle Creek was in the CBS spotlight last night. The network premiered its new police dramedy from Breaking Bad creator Vince Gilligan. Here's a clip from the first episode of the TV show Battle Creek.
The people in this neighborhood, they've never been fans of the cops. And the fact that they were nice while telling me nothing tells me that it's not about us, it's about the crime. These people, they're scared, yes, but I think they're really relieved that these guys are dead. I think that these guys were cooking meth or PCP.
2CP.
What's 2CP?
It's new. The gas chromatograph connected to this mass spectrometer detected several picograms of phenethylamine. Did you find anything else?
Battle Creek focuses on a pair of very mismatched law enforcement officers, FBI agent Milt Chamberlain, played by Josh Duhamel, and Battle Creek detective Russ Agnew, played by Dean Winters. The show portrays the Battle Creek Police Department as facing struggles, understaffed, equipment that doesn't work, underfunded. There is crime, comedy, action, all set in Battle Creek, although not shot there. Well, we wondered how the new show is being received by the Battle Creek Police Department. Chief Jim Blocker is with us now. Thanks for joining us, Chief.
I'm glad to be here.
What did you think of Battle Creek, first as the police chief, but also as a resident of the city?
Well, you know, I thought there's a lot of artistic license when you've got to put something like this together to a national audience. I appreciate the fact there's a lot of humor, because that is true and real life. But I also appreciate there's a lot of effort and focus on the quality of the work. Not only are they having fun, but they're still solving serious crimes at the same time.
Were there any placemaking touches that the show used last night that you thought were especially authentic?
Well, the scene where they're about to hit the door, the raid team, that I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure they took that right out of our storybook, because that did happen, although not to that level of detail. We were about to hit a door, and the person said, no, please come on in, it's unlocked. So we certainly didn't use the RAM.
How would you grade the show in terms of giving viewers a sense of what it is really like to do law enforcement in Battle Creek?
Well, the clip you just ran, what his character, Josh's character, this FBI agent coming to town, he's bringing the new modern technological perspective of police work from not only the high-end mass spectrometer, the forensic science, the lasers, but he also brought shoe booties with him, which is not something that's locally available to many law enforcement agencies. Although our lab is pretty sophisticated today, and yes, we do have a mass spectrometer, I think he's making the point, and the point of the show is that police work has to happen every single day in the communities across America. And no, we don't have all those sexy tools that you're going to see that you see in a show like this, or certainly in bigger shows like CSI and some of the others.
Now, even though, as we were saying, the show is shot in California, but you and your officers did spend some time with some of the cast?
Yes, they did. Josh Duhamel did come in, and he spent about a 24-hour period with some of the undercover officers. Got to witness some of the work being done. Cal Penn not only was in town once, he came twice and was in town for several days each time. And he was able to at least, and I appreciate that an artist, like an actor, would come in and really want to see, develop some authenticity to his character. So he came in town, okay, what is it like to be a cop in Battle Creek and really local town USA, Vice, some of the larger cities that typically take the headlines when we think about police work.
The whole premise of this show is that the police department is struggling, doesn't have all the, like we talked about, the high-tech equipment that some of the big city departments might have, and the gear didn't work. And I just wondered, how does that scenario fit with the issues and challenges that you and your officers are facing in the real world every single day?
Well, I'm going to take advantage of that messaging thoroughly when I go in front of the city manager and the commission for more money. Why wouldn't I? But I think it is telling the story that our community, like many other local communities, technology is changing, and yet we find we're still using our 1990 playbook. We're trying to catch up. Doesn't mean we're not doing a good job. It doesn't mean we're not being thorough. It just means that there are resources out there that are expensive and sometimes beyond our treasury that the community can afford. Now, in reality, we have a lot of good equipment. Officers have to be trained and certified on it. We reach out to our federal and state counterparts all the time if we're missing something, a capability, if you will, or a resource, or just more people to help with a particular problem.
Chief, I'm wondering, do police procedurals like Battle Creek or, let's say, Detroit 187 when it was on ABC, do you think they help or they hurt those of you who do law enforcement for real?
I think sometimes some of the shows, it's expectation management, if you will, at the local level. People think we can do so much more and do it so much quicker and much faster than we really can. You know, for example, homicides are solved in, 46 minutes? and the reality of it is it's going to take 46 weeks, months, sometimes years, before we're going to get down to the truth, a trial, and a conviction.
Yeah, I'm sure the expectations are kind of skewed that way. And then I know with the CSI programs, I think people expect equipment that they use on the show that really doesn't even exist, from my understanding. Some of that stuff is just, well, wouldn't it be cool if we had this? Let's pretend we do.
Right. And so officers find themselves educating the community. No, we can't actually remove fingerprints from that rock. Or, you know, there's just a lot of salesmanship, if you will, from our officers trying to work with people to say, listen, if we could really resolve this quickly, we would. But we simply can't. We still rely on the old gumshoe methods of talking to people, and our reliance on the community is probably now even greater in terms of helping us significantly partnering with us to help keep crime down in our communities, and that's true across the board.
Chief Jim Blocker, Battle Creek Police Department, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Bill Haney has spent many decades in communications and book publishing in Michigan. And the result is a collection of great war stories, the kinds of tales that make you want to park yourself next to him, perhaps on a bar stool, and listen to his memories. Well, here's the next best thing to that bar stool, Bill Haney's new memoir, What They Were Thinking, Reflections of Michigan Difference Makers. There are 18 profiles in the book. Ernie Harwell gets two different chapters, but that's great because it's Ernie Harwell. Bill, just what were you looking for when you chose the people to profile in your memoir?
I think the common denominator really was people who made a difference, whatever field they might be in. Ernie, of course, broadcast, Elmore Leonard, a great crime fiction writer, Sue Marks, I think our number one film producer and director in
Michigan. Oscar winner, yes.
All of these people, and not all were well known. For example, right nearby in Dexter, a young man named Lieutenant Milo Radulovich was involved in something that changed broadcast journalism through Edward R. Murrow, when Edward R. Murrow picked up his story. Fascinating stories, and some of the people were well known and some were not, but they all made a significant difference.
I like that, Michigan difference makers, and they do all have that kind of vision to kind of look past what's accepted and go beyond, but also be authentic to who they are.
Right, and really the reason I wanted to do this book was that while there is much written about many of these people, much of it is, I felt, rather superficial and often redundant. And I felt there was much more to them. For example, Ernie. Everyone feels that they know Ernie. When I first met him in 1984, when he had me on his pregame show for a little Detroit Tigers calendar I had done, so I was his guest. And Ernie invited me up to the broadcast booth for a cup of coffee and to talk about books. And I told Ernie it would be a tragedy if he left this earth without getting all of his stories down. And, of course, he laughed me off and said, nobody's interested in my little 20-second stories between pitches. And I said, well, think about it, Ernie. Well, 2 days later he called, and he had spoken to Miss Lulu that night at dinner about this. And Miss Lulu, of course, said, you listen to that, Mr. Haney. You do that book. And a year later we did.
I want to talk a little about Ernie and the stories you share with Ernie. And boy, you sure picked up at a good time that wonderful year of 84 when they won the World Series. What was it like to walk up into that legendary booth? And Ernie called it the best seat in baseball. Do you remember that?
And it was, very much. It was, a June day in 1984 when Ernie had me on the pregame show. And we did the taping out in the aisle. On the runway up to the grandstand, and he said, come on up and have a cup of coffee. And, of course, right away you hear the crack of the bat, you know, and you smell the hot dogs and all that. And it's so evocative to be there, especially, though, to be in that little booth with Howard Stetzel and Paul Carey. And it is indeed the finest seat in all of baseball. I've been in a number of those booths, many of them with Ernie. But there's nothing like it was at Briggs Stadium, Tiger Stadium. And it was a delight. And, of course, Ernie was just exactly what you would expect that he would be. He was Ernie Harwell. There was no artifice there, no pretense, no social, but yet public Ernie. There was just one Ernie Harwell.
And he was that way with everyone he met, because I know if you cross paths with Ernie, he'd remember you.
Yes.
And really cared about you. And you take us into the hue and cry over Jose Feliciano's version of the Star-Spangled Banner. I remember that being performed in Game 5 of the World Series at Tiger Stadium. That was October 68. And Ernie feared that might cost him his job because he was the one that told him about it. And later in the book, talk about a crisis moment in a sense for Ernie. You take us inside something that truly was one of the biggest blunders that the Tiger front office and radio station WJR ever made. And that was firing Ernie. Well, if you could read us, be so kind as to read us an excerpt from your book, and it's called this chapter is The Inferno at Michigan and Trumbull. And so this is the beginning of when this press conference started.
Right. Well, the baseball staff opened the proceedings with a brief comment that Ernie had a statement he wanted to make, but then stepped quickly aside. Ernie thanked everyone for coming out, Then he got right to it. He said the words that Tiger fans thought they would never hear. And this is Ernie's quote. The Tigers organization has made a decision to go in another direction. The room had already grown quiet the moment Ernie stepped up. Now, except for the cameras, it was perfectly still. They have decided to install a new radio play-by-play man, Ernie said. It was as though an electric current surged through the room. Reporters stopped taking down notes, shook their heads, and looked around at the stunned reactions of their colleagues. Cameramen with gaping mouths zoomed in on Ernie. He was clearly the most composed person there. He said he respected the right of management to make this change, though he did not agree with their reasons for it. Ernie expressed his appreciation for all that the organization had done for him over the years. He stressed that it was the right of a company's management to make personnel changes for whatever reason. Ernie explained that the Tigers had wanted him to say that this was his decision. But he could not do that, because that was not true. He felt his abilities had not diminished, that he was capable of calling the play-by-play well into the future. Now he would stay on only through the 1991 season. When Ernie finished his remarks, it was obvious that most of the journalists had checked their professional detachment at the door.
And boy, those questions began. And of course, we know the Tigers and WJR realized that was a horrendous mistake, and they did bring him back. I'm speaking with Bill Haney about his memoir, What They Were Thinking, Reflections of Michigan Difference Makers. And I want to switch now to a very different but extremely well-known Michigander, Dr. Jack Kevorkian. When you met him, where was he in terms of his notoriety at that point?
He was already well established on his assisted suicide crusade. And my dear friend and a wonderful announcer named Jack Lessenberry knew that I did books. But Jack knew that Jack Kevorkian was going to be going to jail and wanted to have something to do while he was in jail. And he thought he just might want to do a book. And so Jack Lessenberry thought of me, and we met in Jeffrey Figer's office and talked about the book. And the book that Jack wanted to do was a reprint, an update of a book that he had done on dieting. And I thought, just think about that a minute, Jack. The ultimate diet book by Jack Kevorkian. I mean, so that's when I met him, and I kept in touch with him. I had some fine chats with him at some very posh parties. We'd go off and sit in the corner and just people watch and talk about books. And Jack Kevorkian was a brilliant and fascinating guy who, by the way, had memorized the dictionary. And he loved to interrupt a conversation and say, you know that word you just used, the etymology of that word. And he would go off and you could never finish a conversation with him.
I know. I actually crossed paths with him as a reporter, and I remember there was such life in his eyes.
Isn't that an ironic thing? It is true. And Jack was a delightfully droll guy, had a great sense of humor. He was not macabre at all.
Well, certainly there were people who saw him as a crackpot and others, the supporters, who thought of him as a saint. As you got to know him, how did you view him?
I had a very, very warm and I think probably conventional relationship with him. But I found that is true with most of these folks, that they may have this persona and this public image, but at the end of the day, they are really just people. And the one common theme, as I mentioned to you, was that they did make a substantial difference and they cared passionately about what they were doing. Every person in this book, whether it was Denise Illich for education, J.P. McCarthy, all of these people had a passionate belief that they wanted to do the best that they could with the opportunities that they had and be as helpful as they could to as many people as they could. All of them shared that.
It is a fascinating book, and anyone growing up in Michigan will see these names and go, aha, and I want to know more about them. The memoir is What They Were Thinking, Reflections of Michigan Difference Makers. And we want to let you know Bill Haney will be reading from his book and signing it at Literati Bookstore in Ann Arbor, and that'll be tomorrow night at 7 p.m. And some of the proceeds of this book, What They Were Thinking, you are using to fight illiteracy.
That's right. Reading Works in Detroit is a very important program. And we are trying to be as helpful to them as we possibly can in their efforts so that people can at least fill out an application blank and get a start in life.
Again, Literati tomorrow night at 7 p.m., reading and signing What They Were Thinking, Reflections on Michigan Difference Makers. Bill Haney, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Still to come, men are vanishing from workplaces in America, certainly here in Michigan. What that means for our economy, coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
Our next contributor to the next idea challenges us to look back and then look into the future. Look back at Michigan's history as a leader in the field of industrial design. As he puts it, think of Michigan as the Florence of the Italian Renaissance, where anything could be made and designed to improve the lives of millions around the world. And he believes there's every reason for making Michigan the design mecca of the world. Jeff DeBoer is the head of the newly created Michigan Design Council, and he's the owner and VP of Sundberg Farrar. It's one of the oldest industrial design firms in the nation, and it's based in Oakland County in Walled Lake. Good to have you with us, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Exactly. What does an industrial designer do?
Industrial designers marry function and art to create the best product experience that they can possibly achieve. And it's a unique marriage of those two things that delivers great experiences to the people who live in Michigan and anywhere around the world.
And you point out in your essay that Michigan really was on the cutting edge of industrial design, which was when? When did that idea come that instead of handcrafted things, we could make mass-produced products?
So industrial design really came into its own as a profession in the early 1930s. Up to that point, as you point out, it really been more of an arts and crafts movement. Products were made one at a time. There was really no repeatability. And it wasn't really until the early Industrial Revolution when Henry Ford and others started to mass produce products that the industrial design profession did come into its own.
And why was it Michigan that was such a concentration of it?
Well, it's interesting. I think as immigrants moved to the United States, they naturally gravitated to where the jobs were and where early industrial production was taking place, i.e. in West Michigan, furniture industry, Southeast Michigan mm-hmm. with the automobile industry. And it was those industries that really required a better solution to make their products more desirable.
And you tell us that even today, Michigan's got like one of the highest concentrations of industrial designers in the country?
It's true. It's one of those facts that, frankly, I didn't really even understand until I started to dig deeper into this. I think we actually are up to about 4,000 industrial designers working and employed in the state of Michigan, and it's the highest concentration in the country.
So the history that was established in the beginning of the 20th century is still something that is being felt and can carry us into the future.
Absolutely. And I've had folks ask me, it's like, well, gee, Jeff, if we have so many industrial designers, why do we need more? The reality is, as our economy has rebounded, those industrial designers are really quickly getting absorbed into industry, which is a great thing. There really aren't too many industrial designers that aren't fully employed right now. So to keep the economic engine moving forward here, we need more.
Well, in your essay for The Next Idea, you argue that we do need to leverage our valuable asset and our history. And Sundberg Ferrar, your design firm, was asked by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation to form the Michigan Design Council. What is the MDC's goal?
The goal is really to put in motion the governor's strategic plan for the state. There's a key component of the governor's plan that specifically addresses the need for talent. And I think it really is a reflection of his understanding of the important role that talent plays in driving industry and jobs forward in the state.
And where are you in the process right now?
So we have formed the Michigan Design Council. Through the end of last year and beginning of this year, we were contacting individuals and requesting that they come on board as the first foundational members of the council. We have done that. We have about 12 members right now that represent diverse industries and academic institutions around the state.
For instance?
For instance, we have individuals from the automotive industry, Chrysler, General Motors as examples, also from the furniture industry on the other side of the state, Herman Miller, Steelcase, Stryker, Whirlpool, Newell Rubbermaid, and others.
Well, you've got some interesting ideas planned for the council to focus on, and one is to create something you call a design mecca in Detroit. What do you hope that would look like and work like?
Well, I think it could be a physical place. It could be 1 square mile. It could be a block. It could be 10 square miles. But actually a place where designers can go, young and old alike, where they can be amongst their peers. They can develop design businesses. They can collaborate. Other businesses can go to them and find them easily. The other thing that we're really trying to focus on is even if we organically grow industrial designers coming out of our academic institutions, we need a way to keep them in the state. We need a place for them to go. So I think if we have something that we call a design mecca, at least there's a place where they can take their first professional step.
Yeah, and also in the company of more experienced designers further Absolutely. Along in their careers so they could really work off
Act
each other.
As mentors and really grow quickly into the profession.
Well, to attract the talent to Michigan that you're talking about and these jobs, one idea the council is kicking around is to hold an international design competition. What are you envisioning?
Well, we're working on the details right now. We have been benchmarking other organizations around the state, including the Grand Rapids Art Prize, which has been hugely successful in putting Grand Rapids on the map from an art standpoint. So the plans are in the formative stages. The council is vetting various ideas. We're looking at ways to include everybody from K through 12 youth through independent industrial designers, organizations, and companies in the state, and reaching out internationally to involve them.
I'm speaking with Jeff DeBoer, who is the head of the newly created Michigan Design Council, as we explore his essay for The Next Idea. You kind of touched on this, Jeff, but take us deeper. Historically, there's been a kind of an east-west divide among Michigan's design communities. Can you give us a sense of why that is and where it stands today?
Well, part of that is just because of pure geography. Like we said earlier, you know, the heart of Michigan industry has traditionally been based either in southeast Michigan or on the west side of the state with the furniture industry, medical industry, and others. So part of it's pure geography. I think part of it is sort of it's a mental divide. And I think because the reality is most of the industrial designers are fully employed in the state right now. The focus is internally. They're working with corporations. Many of the industrial designers are captive to industries, and they're just very busy and focused on the job at hand. So I think one of the goals of our initiative here with the Michigan Design Council is to build bridges between East and West.
And maybe get more of a Michigan identity versus Southeast Michigan or West Michigan.
Exactly. And there are other organizations on the various coasts of the state that are doing great work, and we certainly don't want to take anything away from that. We really just want to encourage that and help some of those organizations find new reasons and ways to work together.
You certainly kind of throw out a challenge to our schools, but also to young people who are searching for a career path to, hey, think of this. Think of industrial design because you'll get a job in something that pays well.
Well, we're trying to put the arts back in education. And I think, frankly, a lot of this is just lack of information. The reality is creative careers are high-paying, very enriching careers. Industrial designers, and I would say especially industrial designers in Michigan, make an average of probably $10,000 more a year than other industrial designers in the country. But just focusing on the profession of industrial design, it's a real valued career that young people can take. And I think part of what we want to do as a council is reach into the academic institutions, K through 12 and beyond, to really help people understand what those opportunities are.
As the Michigan Design Council takes root and matures, what's your long-term vision?
Well, I think we have a lot of potential initiatives we could tackle. There are many others that are on the table for consideration beyond the Design Prize, beyond the Design Mecca. I'd like to see the council really get into a cadence or a rhythm of rolling out these initiatives and engaging the population of the state and bringing a new focus internationally to the state of Michigan. I think the council would become self-sustaining. We've already had corporate entities contacting us, asking how they can get involved and even sponsor activities, even though our plans are still in the formative stages. So to me, this is really encouraging. These are great early signs. I think there's a hunger for this, and I think it's really neat that we've been able to put a spotlight on industrial design.
Jeff DeBoer is the owner and VP of Sundberg Farrar, an industrial design firm in Walled Lake, and he's the head of the brand new Michigan Design Council. You can find his essay on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Feel free to share your thoughts on the future of industrial design in Michigan in the comments section right under Jeff's essay, or on Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or as always on Twitter at Next Idea MI. Jeff DeBoer, great to meet you. Thank you for your ideas.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Men are vanishing from the workplaces of America, certainly here in Michigan. That group of men aged 25 to 54 who are not working has more than tripled since the late 1960s to 16% nationwide. And for many counties in Michigan, that number is much, much higher. Michigan State economist Charles Ballard is here. Charlie, there was a recent piece in the New York Times exploring the lives of men who are vanishing from the workforce. And it seems this is something already happening before the Great Recession?
That's right. We first started noticing this trend more than 40 years ago, late 60s, early 70s. And then it sort of reached its worst in 2009 at the height of the Great Recession, when 20% of these prime-age men were not working. Now that's down to 16, which is an improvement, but that is still, for the nation as a whole, much higher than we had 40 years ago. And as you said, in many parts of Michigan, the numbers are a lot higher than that.
Now, we're going to crunch those in a minute. Are we looking at, what, foreign competition and technology? Is that what's wiping out the jobs?
It's really a whole host of things, some of which are bad, the loss of manufacturing jobs, the loss of construction jobs, so that there are a lot of these men, especially if they don't have a whole lot of education, who don't fit in well with today's economy. There's other things going on that are maybe not so bad. In some cases, you have stay-at-home dads. 50 years ago, there weren't any stay-at-home dads. It was just culturally that didn't happen. Now that's at least a part of the picture. And so some of these men do have a wife to fall back on economically. Then the other part is the disability insurance program, which has expanded very greatly. It's got pluses and minuses. The minus is we're worried that the disability insurance program may be just a sort of a shadow welfare program and that people really could work, but this is sort of permanent unemployment. On the other hand, we do know there's evidence that most of the people on disability, they really do have serious health problems. I'm glad that we have some social safety net for people who are badly injured or have other health problems that really do make it extremely difficult for them to work.
Well, it certainly seems that if you're someone who's worked, let's say, as a union electrician, and you've been let go and you can't find something, it's going to be awfully tough to take a minimum wage job at a food court and kiss off unemployment or disability benefits or be out there in the public, even just the soul-crushing thing of standing there, you know, serving food at the food court. So what a big mire of problems they get caught in.
Certainly the whole issue of self-worth in a society where people, to a large extent, define their feelings of self-worth in terms of their job. If you've been making $40 an hour at a manufacturing job and then you lose it, even when there's a job that opens up where you could be saying, do you want fries with that? That is a real hit for the self-esteem. And so the data indicate that a substantial fraction of these people, there is a job, there's a minimum wage job out there that they might be able to take, but they haven't sunk that low because they feel like it would be just a huge hit to their sense of self-value to take that lower paying job. Now, in some cases, eventually it gets bad enough and they're forced by financial circumstances to take that low paying job. It's a blow to the psyche.
Let's dig into some of these Michigan numbers, starting with Wayne, Genesee, and Saginaw counties, because talking Wayne County, 33% of prime-age men aren't working. It's 32% in Genesee, 31% in Saginaw, and all of those were heavy auto counties.
In each of those, you've got Flint, Saginaw, and Detroit, a central city with a very large minority population, racially segregated. In many cases, the job is in the suburb, but it's hard to get to the suburb. Also, you have the after effects of the huge increase in incarceration. You've got men who were imprisoned for a time, and then once you've got that prison record, it's much harder to get a job.
And a huge percentage without any bachelor's degree.
In fact, many of them don't even have a high school diploma. Mm. In today's economy, it's just so difficult to get a job if you don't have those skills.
Well, Charlie, let's look at northern Michigan, rural northern Michigan. There are some eye-popping numbers. For example, in the Lower Peninsula, Oscoda, 39%. And in the UP, Luce County, 59%, 49% in Chippewa County. All of these prime-age men, there's percentage not working. What's going on here?
These are areas that have been depressed for decades. I mean, one of the most amazing statistics is that the population of the Upper Peninsula is lower now than it was in 1910. The UP has been depressed for a whole long time. Mm-hmm. If there's any silver lining in these astonishingly high numbers is that they are a percentage, 59% in Luce County, but that's 59% of not many people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a small group. But you've got, I think, in many cases, some of these folks are able to eke out a living sort of in an informal sector. They aren't really working in the traditional sense, but they've got a garden, they chop their own wood, things like that. I mean, if they're alive, they clearly haven't starved to death, so they're managing to piece together a life. But let's face it, in Luce County and Alger County and Lake County, some of these places in rural northern parts of Michigan, there just aren't that many job opportunities. And so if you're going to stay there, you're going to stay in a place. Maybe you're taking care of a relative. Maybe you just can't stand to leave what's been your home. But you're in a place where there just aren't a whole lot of jobs.
Looking at the state as a whole, we have heard Governor Snyder and others talking about the fact that there are jobs that pay well that are going unfilled in Michigan. So what's the disconnect here?
The disconnect is people don't have the right skills, and that's partly an indictment of our high schools. Our education system doesn't do as good a job as it could of connecting the prospective worker to the prospective employer. High school students don't really have as good an idea as they should have of what the jobs are out there. And so the governor's initiative, which I applaud, is trying to improve that transition from school to work. And in many cases, we will be able to solve the problem, I think, with apprenticeship programs, with greater use of community colleges. You know, you and I have talked, and I work for a four-year university, and I'm a big advocate of four-year universities, but not every job requires a bachelor's degree. A lot of jobs, just a training certificate or an associate's degree or something like that will do it.
And I have to wonder for these, you know, 50-year-old men who have been let go and haven't been able to land a good job, is the answer what, to go take a truck driving course or find some type of certification that you can wrap your arms around?
Things like that, I think, may be the best opportunity. But clearly, if you lose your job when you're 53 years old, that is a horrible time in the life to lose a job. You know, young people are used to sort of job shopping, and most people change their jobs a few times before they finally find something that's more permanent. It's tough psychologically, tough physically, and mentally to shift gears and start over when you're in your 50s.
Michigan State economist Charlie Ballard, as always, thank you so much, Charlie.
Thanks, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.